So our next plenary is on how should we approach SDGs differently given the forces and levers at play. So this is trying to tie together the forces from yesterday, from the lightning round, that which seems like ages ago, but that was only last night. The context that we had this morning in that plenary, as well as the levers in this afternoon, or the last two plenaries. So I'd like to introduce our host is Andrew Chunilal from the CEO of Community Foundations of Canada. And he is going to bring up Elizabeth Hendricks from the Freshwater Conservation. Elizabeth is the Vice President of Freshwater Conservation at WWF Canada, a science-based conservation organization. The organization is creating solutions to the most serious conservation challenges facing our planet, helping people and nature thrive. Also, we will have Diane Hodgins from ShoreFast Foundation. Diane is the Chief Financial Officer for ShoreFast Foundation, a charity supporting economic and cultural development on Fogo Island, Newfoundland. Have you ever seen pictures of Fogo Island? If you haven't, just Google it, and you'll want to go there. Fogo Island, Newfoundland, through social business and community development initiatives such as Fogo Island Inn, Fogo Island Shop, and Fogo Island Arts. And last on the panel, we have the future of food. So, Robert, I'm curious to hear your take on how lunch went. With Robert Opp, who's from the UN World Food Program. Robert is the Director of Innovation and Change Management at the United Nations World Food Program, the largest humanitarian relief agency in the world, who is working to end global hunger by 2030. So with that, I'd like to bring up our moderator and speaker.
Thank you. Before I bring up our panel, I just wanted to set the context for our conversation this afternoon. Vinod and Jason had encouraged me to be disruptive and to try and make the audience feel uncomfortable. And normally I could do that quite well. When I look at this audience, that's going to be really challenging for me to do. In part because I work in the community foundation sector, where there's 191 community foundations, and we are not this room. We're a very old movement, close to 100 years. CFC is about 25 years old. We're very traditional organizations. The typical demographics of a community foundation board are vastly different than what I would see in the room. So I'm going to do my best to meet that discomfort and disruption have a great conversation. So what we're going to talk about a little bit is the Sustainable Development Goals in the context of what we can do about them in the future of Canada. And we talked a little bit about 2030 being when these goals will sunset. And so I want to take you into what Canada will look like in 2030. And there's a lot of different lenses we can put on that. We can talk about demographic shifts. We can talk about globalization or climate change or technology and shape or have a sense or hypothesis of what 2030 and beyond will look like. I'm going to take a look at demographics more specifically and paint that picture for you and then challenge certain things within the context of levers that we've been asked to talk about. And the four levers that I would like to have our panel weigh in on are institutions, culture, leadership, and governance. So let me do a little bit of the demographic picture here. And as you know, a lot of the census data in Canada is currently being rolled out. We've got 36 million people in the country. 83 to 84% of that population lives in an urban center. And as you know, our population growth is almost non-existent through fertility. The fertility rate in Canada is about 1.7, so we don't even replace ourselves. The fastest growing demographic that is playing out right now in Canada is our Indigenous population. And the fertility rate in the Indigenous communities is just under 5. And the Indigenous community represents a little under 5% of the total population in Canada. So if we had zero immigration, no refugees at all, we would have population decline, like significant population decline, but the Indigenous proportion of our country would actually become a larger proportion over time. So let's put in some other important elements into this, and that is the death rate. So people in Canada live to roughly, men and women live to roughly 80 years of age. And we have one of the oldest or most aged countries in the world. And so you combine that with a low fertility rate, and it presents some interesting patterns. So let me take you back into the post-World War II environment and immigration in Canada. And the immigration policy in Canada was really centered. Most people came from Commonwealth countries, came from Western and Eastern Europe. And so that provides a particular demographic. Well, that is the demographic that is aging. That is the demographic, and I'll be a little bit blunt here, that is the demographic that is going to die in the next 15 or 20 years as we approach 2030. Now, what's the immigration policy? Well, the Liberals introduced some numbers not too long ago, and we're trying to get those numbers up to, I think, 400,000 or 500,000 people a year. And where are those people coming from? Those people are primarily coming from the global south. So that would be South America, Africa, Southeast Asia, Central America, etc. And so think about 2030 and think about those patterns and think about what Canada is going to look like. Now, the other interesting thing here is we are, in effect, a British country. We have a parliamentary style of government. We have a constitutional monarchy that exists beside the democratic side, and that dichotomy is an interesting one. We believe in the common law. The common law governs a lot of our charitable work and what we do and don't do. It drives a lot of our governance, a lot of our institutions, how we moderate ourselves, how we conduct ourselves in societies. So think about that and think about the change that's coming. What happens when this country isn't necessarily a country that's rooted its people, its identity, its language, its culture, its lineage, it's not rooted in a British background anymore? What happens to institutions? What happens to government? What happens to leadership? And think about that. Those are big disruptions that are in front of us. And so that's the picture that I want to paint. And now I'll invite the panelists up to weigh in on those questions. And I'll invite Diane, Elizabeth, and Robert up to the stage. Let's have the panelists introduce themselves and talk a little bit about their organizations, what they do beforehand, before we jump into the topics. We'll start with Diane.
My name is Diane Hodgins. As was mentioned, I work with ShoreFast out in Fogo Island in Newfoundland. How many people here have been to Fogo Island? Raise your hands. Okay, so it's a pretty good representation. What we're doing out on Fogo Island is really all around economic development. We are working to build a secondary leg to the fishing economy. Newfoundland, as its history is built on the cod fishery in the early 90s, the moratorium came in. Many small communities were wiped out as the fishing was the sole source of their economics. Fogo Island is one of the unique places that in the 60s came together, as the fishermen came together and formed a co-op. And from that co-op, they built their own plant, and fishers still process their own fish in their own plant. And that is one of the main reasons that Fogo Island is still in existence, is because they are contributing into their own economy and have power over their decision-making, keeping things local. So fishing on Fogo Island and many parts of Newfoundland is no longer a sufficient lifestyle. There's not enough economy there to stay. So we're looking to build a secondary leg in tourism, specifically in geotourism. And geotourism is a focus on local, what makes the place very specific, what it is special, and looking to build economic models around the specifics of that locale. The first project that we started with is with art. The National Film Board came out in the 60s and were very integral in Fogo Island finding a path forward, bringing the community together to have a discussion around forming their own economic unit for a co-op. So our first investment was in art. So we have a contemporary residency program on Fogo Island. And many people say, why contemporary art in a remote place in Newfoundland? And art is a way of just approaching problems differently. As we've identified in several of the speakers, we're very complex problems. We don't have a path forward. Art is a way of investing in discovering some new solutions to problems. So we have an artist residency program. We have a business program as well, small loans, getting small businesses up and off the ground. The Fogo Island Inn is a 29-room luxury property where we're attracting a different market to Canada, different way of hosting hospitality in Canada at a very premium market. And last year, in the last couple of years, we've also ventured into a fish business. We are selling cod, hand-lined cod, out of Newfoundland into the Ontario high-end market. So a broad swath of things, and so I've said at the beginning, we're building a secondary leg to the fishing economy, and we're trying to do that through a number of enterprises. We have a number of social businesses. They are for-profit businesses. We do not have outside ownership. They are owned by a charity. And so in that, the goal is to keep everything as local as possible. I'm a chartered accountant. My background is in business. So the work that I do in is building systems and building businesses that support not only the culture, but the economic viability. Because without economic viability, we have nothing left than to support the cultural investment and keep people at a local level. So this is the space that I work in is always in this balance of growth and preserving, focus on culture, but also find a way to generate profit, generate income. And so my background was working in for-profit and non-profit. I found it very hard to switch from the social good that was happening in the not-profit sector and for-profit just being all about growth and business being used in a specific way. Shorefast is really trying to invest in that center space. I think it's where these two areas collide, and I think this is where we're going to see the most transformation. We would like to see all businesses being not just for-profit businesses. What does that look like? If we get rid of all of these different institutions, I can tell you it'd make it a lot easier to try to run all of the operations that are socially minded within, the confines we have now. But anyways, that's a little bit of an intro.
Thank you, Diane. It sounds like Shorefast is doing some very non-conventional things in a conventional space.
Yeah.
Robert?
Yeah, so my name's Robert Opp. I'm the Director of Innovation and Change Management at the United Nations World Food Program. To start with the problem we're trying to solve, there are an estimated 815 million people affected by hunger globally. The second sustainable development goal is to end hunger by 2030. So that's a big challenge. The United Nations World Food Program is the largest humanitarian agency in the world. We're present in 82 countries. We reach between 80 and 100 million people a year with some form of food assistance that initially was actually mostly food distributions, and now we are also doing a wide range and high volume of cash distributions for people. The issue with solving hunger as a global problem is that we're actually making progress against hunger. In the last 15 years, despite population growth, hunger has dropped from about a billion people affected to 815 million, which is good news. However, the bad news is that at that rate of progress, there is no way we're going to reach zero hunger by 2030. So we need to look at how we're going to accelerate that work. And one of the reasons that I come in as a head of innovation for the World Food Program is to look at how we can leverage the new approaches, technologies, business models that are available to us now that may not have been available before to really bring to bear on that problem of global hunger. And it's to do that, we built up an innovation infrastructure in the organization. We are, it's a large bureaucracy, it's a public sector, international public sector institution. But we are really trying to make the World Food Program more agile and able to embrace those new approaches and techniques. And so we have built up an innovation accelerator that is able to support internal ideas as well as external startups that are working in the hunger ecosystem or space. We have got everything from the kind of very low-tech type activities of post-harvest loss, giving subsidized or financed silos to small farmers so that they can preserve their crop and market it more along a time schedule that suits them and is better for prices. But at the same time, we have, as Ethan was saying in one of the last panels, we have a blockchain-based digital voucher system that's operational with 10,000 Syrian refugees in Jordan based on an iris scan, biometrics and things. That system is more advanced than a retail system in Canada. And so we're interested in artificial intelligence, in blockchain, in biotechnology, and things that are really going to help us make progress. And it's really, for us, about bridging what's being developed in the Silicon Valleys of the world, Berlin, London, New York, etc. How can we accelerate the progress of democratization of that technology and put it in the hands of people who are furthest behind and who need that technology most urgently?
Thank you, Robert. Elizabeth?
Hi. First of all, this has been a fantastic conference, so I really appreciate being invited to speak. So I work for WWF Canada, and many might know WWF International, and WWF Canada is unique in our international network in that most of our programming is within Canada. So we are a science-based conservation organization. We focus in the Arctic, ocean, freshwater, nature-connected community, and so science and innovation. And so I'll speak to the freshwater program because that's what I lead. And I know Jason asked us to think future, but I am going to step back and say I grew up across the country. My father was actually in mining, and so we grew up in really small resource-based communities. And this matters because WWF Canada, as a national organization, working in water is really hard to talk water. Canadians care about water because whatever is happening in their backyard. And so we really work in our program to manage that national to local scaling, and how do we, or I should say local to national scaling, we try and scale up. And so we work in the Skeena and Smithers. I have a staff in New Brunswick along the St. John River. We work in the north around free-flowing and wild rivers and how to work with First Nation communities there. And we work in the Great Lakes, as well as some of our national programming. So where I find myself today and looking future is as a self-identified policy wonk. I find myself at this intersection, this confluence between water, technology, and communities. And it's really interesting, how do we, you said democratization of technology, and I think it's democratization of data. People, we need to move off a natural resource-based economy. I think Canadians, we've been slow to do it. I think that the demographics you speak of will help us accelerate that move and change in our economic system. But until then, we're seeing this pushback on natural resource. Communities are getting nervous about how our resources are being used. You see this around pipelines, fracking, a lot of energy development, and it often comes down to how are water resources in those communities going to be used. And I really believe it's because we've separated those discussions. Energy, resources, mining, forestry are separate from basic air quality, water concerns. And what we need to do, and what we're trying to do in different ways in our program, is help communities make place-based decisions. So what are the trade-offs communities need to be making that feel good for them and for what they need to do in the future? And so that's where we've been trying to figure things out.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thanks. I hadn't quite appreciated the diversity of the panel. You know, I'm talking about a different type of diversity. You know, and Diane's working locally in a very, very small community in Canada, and doing some really good work there. Robert is working at the level of the UN and working globally, and Elizabeth is working in a global organization doing work here locally in Canada. So I think that's set up for a really rich discussion in terms of what we'll tackle. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to go back to something that you mentioned, Diane. I was curious about all the institutions that you've had to set up to deliver on positive social outcomes in Fogo Island. And I could hear it in your tone. It's like, I wish there was another alternative where I could create one organization to do all the different things that I could do. And it speaks to the potential obsolescence or threat to the current institutions, at least the ones that we have in a Canadian context and maybe even globally. We have things that we call charities in Canada, and they're very discreet in terms of what they're allowed to do. Mm-hmm. If you think about the social, the Sustainable Development Goals, there's a lot of goals there that are interrelated, they're indivisible, and they're complex. And are our institutions able to address those things, or do we need an alternative? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, charity, there's charity law, there's charity taxation law. And then when you pile on top of that, the HST rules, the employment rules, the rules across organizations between the for-profit and non-profit model, it's a very, very complex system. Even if you have a long career in working all of these silos, trying to manage across, you end up with a very large administrative burden, which then is a deterrent to innovation because it's hard to think outside the box when you're constantly trying to manage and make sure you're putting everything in the right box. We would love to see a world, and I said it in my opening discussion, what does a not-just-for-profit look like? So we have for-profit corporations, and for-profit corporations have the most wide scope in terms of how income can be distributed, how income can come in. A charity is on the far other end with the most limited because a charity has the capacity of issuing donation receipts, and there's a tax consequence there. But what's it stopping us from having for-profit corporations act with the same social conscience as a charity or a same social conscience and what tends to be in the nonprofit sector? There's nothing legally that's stopping us. We've talked to a couple of boards that went out and said to the board, how much profit should we really make? What are we doing to take this business model and have it in service of the community? Are we paying enough wage to the local community? Do we source locally? Do we try really hard to source locally? How much money should our senior management take home? What is a realistic bonus? And how are we investing local? How are we trying to keep the money as local as possible? So we have the means, and I think one of the things that I've struggled with in this field of social enterprise is trying to figure out where everything is. Social enterprise, in many ways, is still in the nonprofit mindset. We're trying to break that through in the for-profit mindset. I think social enterprise, for myself, is a practice of business. Business has become a little bit self-serving, trying to make more money. We're very good at making money. You know, Canadians and the world, we're very good at producing money. We're not very good at this distribution of money, our relationship with money, and how to keep money local, and how to have it continuing investing in the places where the money is extracted from. That is the part that we haven't figured out. And that's a big change. And back to the institutions, what if we all started acting in the best interest of social impact? Whether you're a for-profit, a non-profit, a trust, a corporation. We've added this huge layers of complexity in order to try to, we allow ourselves the for-profits to do, some not so good things. And then, we give money to the charities to do the good things. Why don't we just do it all good in the first place? And a for-profit environment allows us to do that. But this term profit has been also associated with not, your business is bad or business done wrong. We have the opportunity now to orient the way that we approach business, orient the way we approach economics in service of community and in service of people.
Thanks, Diana. Robert, would you care to build on that a little bit and perhaps draw upon your global experience? And I know you work out of Rome. Diane mentioned this idea of charity. Is that something that's consistent throughout the world in terms of how we define it? Or do you experience that other cultures would bring in different elements to what charity looks like or even what good looks like?
Well, I do think that there's a common element, let's face it, in most religions of charitable action. And so when we are working in different contexts, we usually kind of link to one form or another of that. But I would say on the institutional lines of things, you mentioned the SDGs and how we're going to reach them and the fact that, you were saying that could we all not just focus on social impact, right? If you look at what the SDGs represent, they are the first time that humanity, the nation states of the world, which is also a modern institution, but nation states of the world have come together and said there are 17 things that we need to take care of. They are unique. 15 years ago, we had the Millennium Development Goals, but they only covered part of the issues. They only covered what was classified at that time as social and economic development, whereas now we have climate change and human rights and everything else bundled in. The reality is, though, our institutions are not well set up to deal with things holistically. So World Food Program has its mandate, and we provide food assistance. But actually, 15 minutes down the road, there's another agency, the Food and Agriculture Organization, that is an agency of the United Nations that has a mandate of food production and policy support for governments, which is fine. But and then it multiplies from there, reproductive health and other health systems and education and so on. And, you know, the saying that when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, comes into play. And so we're trying to figure out now with the SDGs how to organize ourselves as a system, and that's just the UN. We're not even talking about NGOs and other civil society elements yet, and we haven't even started to talk about private sector. So that's a real problem of how organizations, institutions that have been set up with a certain mentality are able to then kind of think outside those silos and find ways of collaboration. And I would extend that, because I just mentioned private sector, in what we're trying to do with innovation. What we bring to the table as the World Food Program is pretty deep, extensive field presence and country or community knowledge that is exactly the kinds of channels that private sector would look for to create sustainable business models if they were interested in that, but they don't necessarily know how to access. So we're trying to find ways to match the interests of private sector, who would like to have some of that delivery of business models, technologies, et cetera, with the realities of people who need services, financial services and others, education and so on. But the reality is our institutions, as at least the United Nations, are not great at partnering either, because our notion of partnership and institutional partnership is really rooted in some very distant past, probably 1950s. And so we do struggle with that.
Thank you, Robert. Elizabeth, would you like to build on that?
Yeah, so I think the first piece is the SDGs, like you said, first time humanity is coming together and saying we have these 17 problems. And I think Canadians need to admit that they need to be addressed in Canada. We have energy poverty, we have First Nation communities who don't have access to, many communities, including First Nations, that don't have access to drinking water. Plenty of issues along our coasts due to economic issues, you know, you see in Newfoundland and Atlantic regions. So I think, are we prepared to acknowledge that and then address that in our institutions? So that's a kind of first, let's admit that. Second, I love the institutional question, because it is something we are wrestling with at WWF, and because we are a colonial organization, our roots are in a colonial approach. And so what does that mean? Our conservation programming, where it touches down, works with communities across, with First Nations, with a variety of communities. And so how do we make sure we're supporting those folks on the ground working? So sometimes my job is, to be very practical, I sometimes feel like my job is to make sure the bureaucracy of my institution stays out of the way of my staff working on the ground so that we can be nimble. So what does that mean, and kind of what are the things that we're wrestling through is NGOs in general in Canada are coming out of the big chill. There was a lot of scrutiny over the past decade around taxation and are we charitable and are we respecting those rules, and so I think that will have lasting effects. I think we spoke to a lot of discussion today around funding restrictions and accountability, and I like what Ethan said about blockchain can help with that accountability. Address it helps with that accountability, because that's something that I struggle with funding. I want my funders to know I'm accountable, that WWF is accountable to the work we do. We also need to figure out a way, how can we be accountable but be nimble to work on the challenges, because they're complex, and sometimes what we envision as a project is not, it changes drastically over a 5-year period, and how do we allow that to happen without being like, it's not a failure, it's we're adapting to a situation, and so how can we work through those systems?
Thank you, Elizabeth. One thing that was mentioned, actually it's been mentioned all day long, is this idea of democratization. You mentioned the democratization of data, democratization of technology. Diane, in the Fogo Island context, we would talk about the democratization of philanthropy. When we put that word out there, it implies that somewhere in the supply chain, if you will, there's power and privilege being exercised in a way that we might not be comfortable with, or it's not quite optimized. In your context, can you speak to power and privilege, where it resides, and what are the barriers to democratizing your work?
I'd say, so I'll talk about sort of from the financial side. I say that transparency is the new green. You know, we've come out of the green phase, we're going into the transparency phase, and all of these technology platforms are really giving us this opportunity to share data in a way that we haven't had before. And this this discussion around, it's come up a few times today, where does your money go? Financial markets tend to be a bit of a black. You don't know where the money goes. You know, people like their funders to have comfort, that they're accountable, and this is where things are coming out. So I think that we're on a wave of technology that's going to allow us then to build financial systems and accounting systems that just becomes openly transparent, and there will be live financial data that's shared out. And this is something that we struggled with internally with the services we've provided and some of our products. So we came up with a concept. It's called an economic nutrition label. And I left some cards just over on the side. But what it is everyone became very comfortable with the food nutrition label. And it shows you what you're eating, how many calories are in it, how much fat, how much sugar. So for all of the products and services that we provide in our social business on Fogo Island, we give you an economic nutrition label. And it shows where all the money went for every product and service that you purchased from us. So there's two parts to it. The top shows how much is labor, how much is materials, and how much in our pricing model we have a percentage that goes back to our charity, because we are a social business and our charity is the lifeblood and the energy and the ideas of all that we do. Our businesses are how we translate them out. What I find is the most impactful piece of this label is on the bottom we have the geographic breakdown of where the money goes. So I can identify, if you stay with us, X percentage stays in the community of Fogo Island, X percentage stays in the province of Newfoundland, X percentage stays in Canada, and X percentage is distributed around the rest of the world. And I think this is this kind of, this transparency piece where we're starting to think about each one of us as consumers have a huge amount of potential on impacting the economics of our communities, of our country, and of our nation. And if we have better transparency and understanding, if I spend this dollar, I know where it's going. It's my choice. I may choose to pay a higher price point for something that goes back and has a social purpose, or I may not be in a financial situation to do that. But back to this democratization, I think we have an opportunity now to create systems and do much better communications of data in ways that are relatable, which I think right now that's a challenge with some of these blockchains. It's so unrelatable, we can't find a way. We need communication systems that we can all, we get it. Oh, yes, okay, I know how to take an action from this. I know what this is communicating to me, and now I'm empowered to have a different channel. So this is our biggest innovation around that communications platform. As an accountant, I find it hugely exciting. I'm very excited about blockchain and what that all can be. I don't know if there's any other accountants in the room. But tools like that is definitely something that we're interested in, because if you know where your money is going, it changes your behavior in terms of how you interact with that product or service. You have comfort. And I think that's one of the technology is advanced in market. We're all connected around the world. Things move fast. We can get what we need. But we're missing a piece. And, you know, economic systems used to be tied to place. Money used to be tied to place. If we got in an argument and you made a bad decision of business or vice versa, I saw you at the grocery store and we're going to have to deal with each other for the rest of our lives. That still happens on Fogo. I mean, many people come up to me in the grocery store. There's 2,500 people there. That's one of the unique things about starting a business innovation in small places. Your decision making in business and in economics and in all things, you come back and you feel the repercussion of your action. It's a very short feedback loop. And I think that technology advancement has been such a detriment for us to make smart decisions that affect humanity, because we do not have reciprocal relationships anymore with people. Our data systems have wiped that out. That reciprocity is gone. I can make a decision that wipes out your entire community from in my remote place, in my boardroom, in some other country. That's not right. That's where data has failed us. So we need to get back to investing in the human systems, using data and business as a tool, in service of community and people, we've got it flipped around, so we have an opportunity to try to reorient.
Thank you, Diane. One of the reasons we brought Diane is she's probably the coolest accountant in the sector. Most accountants don't talk this way. Robert, over to you.
Yeah, I would subscribe to everything that Diane has said about transparency and so on. When I use the term democratization, though, in addition to that, it's the notion that some of the game-changing, life-changing, world-changing technologies that are being developed now that are being put toward, let's say, more efficient or faster grocery delivery in San Francisco could be leveraged to look at inefficient food systems in Africa, inefficient supply chains, which is a major problem. But the issue is that that's not perceived as commercially interesting. And some of the panels earlier today touched on this issue, and I think it was Ilse from Mars that said something about we need new entrants into the social finance marketplace. And that's exactly it. It's sort of cell phone penetration in sub-Saharan Africa is about 75% right now. And you see cell phones in the last 5 years, sort of if there's those of you who've sort of traveled in these places, you can see it's just dramatic what's happened in the last 5 years, an explosion of cell phone penetration, which is great because that's a life-changing device, a life-changing service. But how many years have we had virtually ubiquitous cell phones in Canada at 75%? So it's probably 15 years or so that we've been at that level, and Europe was there before us. So the issue is, why do we have to wait for that period of time? Why can't we find the right models to stimulate investment for those who need it the most now, in addition to serving the commercial marketplaces that we have in the developed world? And I know that that's kind of idealistic. I know it's a little bit naive in some ways, but I believe that there are models that can be used. And we do see some of this. You know, Google and Facebook talking about universal internet with drones and balloons and stuff like that. They have deep enough pockets that they can do that. It's the smaller and medium-sized startups that are really struggling from quarter to quarter to meet the demands of the venture capitalists are the ones that really are not able to think more laterally like that. And we need to look at those incentives.
Thank you, Robert. Elizabeth?
So this... I feel like I'm getting such great comments, and the question started back at power and privilege, right? I was just so enthralled with this power and privilege. So I work in water and data, and this past June we released this big report that said, first national assessment of watersheds in Canada, that said we have major impacts on our watersheds. We actually don't understand or collect the data allowing us to understand those impacts. So through that process, because you speak to power and privilege, lots of calling governments in different jurisdictions, and do you have this type of data? We need this. Can you share it? Big challenge, really hard. 4 years of three full staff really working the phone lines and email. And then we'd get the results and we'd share it because sometimes more data would come available. If it was a bad story, they'd say, oh, actually, we have more data. Here. No. And once we had... fascinating discussion, and this person said in a jurisdiction, a larger jurisdiction, said, you can't publish this information. What will people think? Their phosphorus levels were through the roof, far beyond guidelines. And the reaction was, you can't share this. People will... And so before we get self-righteous, part of me felt for the bureaucrat. I said, he's the one who's going to be dealing with the phone calls when people say, oh my God, what is this? The other half of me said, this is an education opportunity. It's not holding, we still have that mentality of we need to hold the data, government is right, we will take care of Canadians and our water. I don't think Canadians want that anymore. This rise of citizen science, so we're also launching, in response to this report, part of our next steps is launching a citizen science program across the country because people want that hands-on, it allows people to connect with their environment, whether it's water, species, but in this specific program, by collecting data in their community, they get that hands-on. You care more when you're out in the community, when you're out on your freshwater resources, your lake or your river, and
it allows you to understand, have a better context to that data. So it's just not someone like passing that information to you in this passive way or assuming government has control or management of it. It is a shared responsibility. I often say water is a shared resource, a shared responsibility. So there's that piece. It's in terms of the democratization of data. It's allowing, you know, it's not just government. Government can't afford to just monitor for every community. So it's that shared responsibility. The next piece to it is do many people have access to it? Are we creating open databases? Another initiative is around using blockchain to secure water data. There is real concerns of people who do community-based monitoring, First Nation communities who say, we've had companies pay us to do monitoring, and then they take that data and we don't get it back. And so creating those tools to allow it, to allow that not to happen, that it is accessible to everyone, and opens the opportunity for anyone to do analysis on water. You know, there's some really, you could do water and air quality analysis, trend analysis, like there's lots of ways of playing with data that if we create open sources allows that to happen. And then there's also, I've already confessed that I'm a policy wonk. So I have my technical people talk to me, and I really have to say, I don't understand what you're saying. Did you have to slow down? So it's how are we communicating that data? And that you mentioned communication as a vital tool. You can have all the data in the world. We've talked about big data. You can have big data. It's too much unless you provide accessible ways of understanding it and analysis. So you need, it's not just one piece. You need all those three pieces to get to that democratization. And I think you can, you know, it's easy to say, well, we're just going to focus on this one, but then you're leaving the other two pieces behind. So it's really how do we bring up systems that are trying to bring all those pieces together along at the same time.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Yeah. I'm going to stay with you on this one and work this way this time around. Go to another lever that we can look at, and that is culture. And what I mean by that is cultural at the organizational level, but also within what we would call the ecosystem. And Robert mentioned Silicon Valley earlier, and what really makes Silicon Valley tick is that it has its own culture that that encourages innovation and risk-taking, and through that it lands outcomes within that. And when you get to Silicon Valley, you can feel that you're within that system, that ecosystem that promotes that type of behavior. We also have a culture in our organizations, in our ecosystem. It tends not to be that. In fact, in many ways, it's very, you know, decision-making is centralized. There's lots of hierarchy. There's lots of structure, process. Failure can be punitive. And that gets in the way of innovation. It gets in the way of real, bold, big bets. Can you comment on, you know, in respect of the future of good, in respect to getting to 2030 and what we want to accomplish, how does culture have to change within our sector, within our ecosystems, our organizations, and how do we get there?
So we do have to change. I think environmental NGOs, the success, we want to ultimately see success on the ground. I want to see healthy waters in our future. I think we all deserve it. We all expect access to it. That takes some of the problems. Grassy Narrows in Northern Ontario is mercury problems. That's not going to be solved in a year. And so when I have to report back to donors or do our annual public meeting, we're looking for how did we make impact. And it's really hard to say, well, we didn't save that. These are long-term issues. So I think we tend to sometimes invest as an industry in safe wins. What's a win? What's a fast win that we can communicate to show that we have value as an organization? You know, that what's that campaign that we can, you know, is it a media campaign? Is it to demonstrate success in a short term? But the problems that we're really ultimately trying to address take longer than that. So we need to be honest about that longevity. We need to be honest, and I think be risk adverse. Again, back to that policy wonk thing, and I'm joking, oh, I am working in blockchain and trying to figure it out, or environmental DNA technology in processing water samples. We have to be willing to try those things. And so next year, I might,
you know, with my tail between my legs, say, yeah, that was a terrible idea, sorry. But we have to be willing to try them. That means we need systems willing to allow us to take those risks, to try new ways, to try to bridge stakeholders that don't usually get together. Like technology and water policy folks don't tend to hang out together, and so how do we bridge those gaps?
Thank you, Elizabeth. Robert?
Yeah, I think nonprofits in general are incentivized to severely control any risk at all and avoid any loss, because the press that you get or the impact of a lost sort of, you know, whether it's a food diversion in our case or a loss of cash or a scandal of some kind far outweighs what you get when you take a risk and something really good happens. So that incentive structure has to change. And, you know, we've been facing this over the last few years in the World Food Program about how to educate our membership, our executive board, which is made of member states of the United Nations, and our own staff to, you know, we've got over 50 years of public sector oversight thinking. We have layer upon layer of controls that have been stacked on everything from procurement process and legal and all the other sort of stuff, finances. And we've been sort of trying to work on clearing that away a bit to say, actually, is that control really necessary in this day and age? Or can we relax on that and stimulate a little bit more risk-taking and innovation? So it's not an easy situation, but I do see it changing both inside the organization as well as among our members. But it's highly variable depending on who you speak to and where you're, what country you're representing.
Thank you for that, Robert. Diane?
So I'll speak on the culture of our organization on Pogo Island. If people know any Newfoundlanders, they're predisposed to hospitality, love of a stranger, a very open community. So that has helped us as a culture in terms of being open to new ideas, because I'd say that's just embedded in the physical location, in the communities there. I think that we have a real unique opportunity in Canada. We have so many remote places and so many resource-based economies here where economies have been built on human relationship with nature, fishing, in Newfoundland. Those communities understand that you can't put everything in a very clear straight line in a plan. Anybody that works with Mother Nature knows nothing goes exactly according to plan. So I think Pogo Island has a unique asset, I would say, in it's a fishing community that understands you can plan to an extent, and then you need to be malleable to the reality of what's going to happen in that situation. So I think resource-based economies across the country, rural places especially, that have had to self-navigate through, you know, a difficult winter or a natural disaster, those small places are much more resilient than some of our larger cities, that there's an incentive that someone else has a plan for us when this all goes down. Small places know that we just have each other. And we use this phrase in our senior team and with our staff as well, saying, you know, we are the Oompa Loompas. You know, some will say, Shorefast should you do this. You know, we should do this. And I always look around and say, well, we're it. Like, there is nobody else. So I've been trying to challenge everyone when they say, you know, we should do this. I say, can you please give me who? If it's me, just say, Diane, I think we need to do this. Come on board. Like, I'm all in. But I think this concept of someone else will take care of us has also been a bit of a challenge as we navigate these massive programs. We think that there is a government entity that has a solution somewhere. We're all here because I think we know it's not there. We have to figure this out ourselves. So in our organization, as far as the culture, we have a very entrepreneurial culture, I think, because of people that had to live, you know, in a natural environment. And then we have a very strong leader. If anyone hasn't, our leader is Zita Cobb, and she has just a totally different way of approaching business, approaching the world, and approaching on a very strong focused community. So in terms of leadership, I think you need to have resilience, open to new ideas, and professionals that come into a new space, accept that you don't have the answers. Go in, try to find out what are all of the problems before your predisposed ideas of what you took from your previous skill set comes in, because a lot of the time your answer is going to be way off base, and then you're not really open to the changes that need to have to be made.
Thank you, Diane. I think we have time for one more question, so I'll go to the next lever, and that is leadership. And maybe we can keep our responses to a couple of minutes so we don't go over time. So it's a fairly simple question, but quite open-ended in a way. There's been a lot that's been talked about over the last day and a bit. What's the largest challenge for leadership in getting to good in the future? And I'll start with you, Robert.
I think that, one of the largest challenges for leaders are being the ones that are going to, step forward first and take the bet, and take the risk of, because if I think about public sector and related to the last sort of question that you were asking, and there's a risk averseness in nonprofits in general, and certainly in the international public sector where I come from. It takes a lot of guts to say that we are going to transform this organization and actually do it. It's pretty easy to make that announcement, but to follow through and beat down all the forces of resistance that are going to come up is really challenging. And I see that in an everyday sort of battlefront scenario, to really try to push change in an organization that actually thinks the world is just fine the way it is, and thinks that our model is just fine the way it is. But when I look at the game-changing, life-changing impact that universal internet connectivity is going to have on people, it is imperative that we are thinking ahead and thinking about how power structures are going to change and how we make that work for people who are the most vulnerable, and instead of just telling ourselves everything's fine and our model's just fine.
Thank you, Robert. Elizabeth?
I would say tough question, big question, that I think a big one is transparency, that a leader is going to be transparent about strengths, weaknesses of institutions, of structures, of the own organization. Are we willing to change to get to the good we need? I think we need to see leaders who are building teams around them that have strengths and weaknesses. Diane, to your point, there are no magical solutions out there that we're just waiting to come along. We've got to kind of figure it out, and not one of us will do it. And so leadership requires that team to really do that heavy lifting on the thinking, and then the heavy lifting on the doing as well.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Yeah. Diane, you get to close us out.
I would say it's an unwavering faith that we will figure it out. Remaining positive, remaining that it's just one step in front of the other, presenting it that we don't have the solutions, but just in confidence that we will find something there. And I think people are looking for an energy to keep them going. This is tough work. We're carving, it's all new. Everything is from scratch. So every day is very trying. It's very hard. And it's also, with that comes with a lot of negative. So the leadership has to be able to, like, take it all, know how much to react to, in one ear very open to all the positive, and one ear slightly deaf. And that's okay. And being able to keep moving forward and being confident that we don't know the answers now, but we have a path forward, and we're all in this together, and I'm here. And we're going to do this in an unwavering faith that there will be success in the long run.
Thank you, Diane. Now, that was a great panel. Round of applause.